The early and crowded race for the White House. Even if you're a politics wonk, it is hard to keep up with the field of candidates who have announced they are running for president. Depending how you count, right now there are about 16 major candidates for the Democrats and 2 for the Republicans. Officially, the number is much higher. On the Federal Election Commission website, you can scroll through the 599 candidates who have filed for the race. And these numbers don't even include the potential frontrunners, such as Joe Biden. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What does this huge field of candidates portend? What do American voters really want? Will the Democrats nominate someone who can successfully challenge President Trump? We have a great panel of experts to discuss those questions next. But first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Seems like every day we hear about someone new throwing his or her hat into the presidential race. Our guest today will help us cut through all the noise to understand who is really in or out and what to watch for in the months to come. Joining me in the studio, Tony Corrado, professor of government at Colby College. He is also regarded as one of the nation's leading experts on campaign finance. Ron Schmidt is an associate professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. His most recent book is Reading Politics with Machiavelli. And in our Bangor studio, Emily Kane, executive director of Emily's List and former Maine state legislator and candidate for Maine's 2nd Congressional District. As always, we want to hear from you. What candidate do you think has the best chance? Do you think there are people who still ought to enter the race or people who ought to drop out? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome back to all of you. What a fantastic panel today. And I'm going to start by asking you all the same question, which is, as you follow this cavalcade of candidates entering the race, what are you thinking, Tony?
Well, I'm thinking we're looking forward to a very interesting Democratic contest this year. We have the most diverse field of candidates the Democrats have ever seen. We've never seen so many women candidates, so many candidates of color, such geographic diversity, so many different background experiences amongst the candidates. So that what you're seeing here is both the fact that Democrats think this is a very good opportunity to win the presidency in 2020 because of Donald Trump's continuing weakness. And at the same time, you're seeing the new politics of the Democratic Party, which is much more open to non-traditional candidates and therefore creating an attitude within the party that, why not me? Why not have myself take a shot at the presidency and see how well I do?
Ron?
I agree. We usually hear this sort of assumption that a Democratic path to victory for national office is fairly narrow, that there's a certain sort of moderate vision of what Democratic victory looks like. And I think that what we're seeing this year is a much broader set of ideas about what victory can look like over what the Democratic Party now stands for. And thus far, at least, I think I'm just seeing a lot of very strong positive energy.
Emily?
Well, for me, Jennifer, as a Democrat, I couldn't be more thrilled at the strength of this field, even if it is large and growing every single day. But what makes me particularly excited are the women, and most of whom are occupying the top tier of these candidates. That so many women are running for our nation's highest office is fantastic and speaks to the strength of who these women are as candidates and of women who are driving change in this country. And for us at Emily's List, an organization that for more than 30 years has been working to elect these women to office, we are just so thrilled to see women taking the lead. And with multiple women running, I will say we should consider this the new normal. I hope and believe we will never again have a Democratic presidential primary, or Republican for that matter, that doesn't include multiple women at the top tier.
Emily Kane, Emily's List, which you're executive director of, helps pro-choice Democratic women run for office. Does that mean you are right now helping 6 women run for president? How does that work?
You know, that's a great question. So this is a literally new normal for us, too. And at Emily's List right now, we're doing a lot of work to try to support all of the women running by helping level the playing field for them. Because what we know is that while we're excited that there are so many women running, those women are still facing sexism in the way the media covers them, in the way their opponents talk about them. These questions like electability, likability, authenticity, those are really code words for this is a candidate that I have not really experienced before and can easily be called sexism. And so for us at Emily's List, we are working to call that out and really trying to make the case that there's not a sub-primary for the women to get through to get to one. And I think a lot of people are sort of treating them as if they're competing only against one another, when in fact we think it's exciting. We can talk about who they are as individuals, what they are fighting for, the plans they are putting forward, and the coalitions they are building. So as of right now, we are not endorsed in the presidential primary. We may have the opportunity to do that later in the process, but right now we're supporting all of these women and helping to level the playing field for them.
Ron Schmidt, obviously one of the themes Emily's just talking about, six leading women in the Democratic field. What are some other themes emerging this time around?
Well, there's an argument going on about whether the party has a better chance at victory and at repudiating President Trump and his legacy by either following sort of a newer, more progressive energy or by trying to appeal to those voters who surprised me, at least, with their support for Donald Trump in 2016. So women actually are on various sides of that debate. Amy Klobuchar, for example, has made the case for herself from the very beginning that she is someone who can reach out to the voters who voted for Trump last time and convince them to change back.
Tony, your expertise, among others, is on finance. I went onto the Federal Elections Commission website this morning, and behind Donald Trump, the number two person right now is John Delaney. Is it too early for that to have any meaning at all, or does that tell you something?
No, it's too early for that to have any meaning at all. And the reason why John Delaney looks so good on the FEC report is that he's been spending his own money running for president. But I think that you are going to see the money be a very different kind of a factor in the 2020 race, in part because if you remember 4 years ago when the Republicans were all at this same point, all of them were busy chasing large contributions. Most of the candidates had a super PAC set up to accompany their campaign committee, and there was this kind of money frenzy. What you're seeing with the Democrats this time is almost the reverse of that, with many candidates calling to not accept corporate PAC money, many of the candidates saying that we don't want to have an affiliated super PAC, and a real emphasis on small donors as the new measure of whether a candidate is going to be successful. So there's been a kind of very different posturing about money that we've seen so far.
What do the polls tell us at this point? And again, do they matter?
I don't really think that the polls matter at this point. They're largely name recognition. So you're always going to see Biden and Bernie up at the top. You're always going to see Kamala Harris doing well because she's gotten quite a bit of media attention early in the race. But I think what does matter at this point in terms of the polls is just looking at the 1% mark. And the reason why I say that is because it's a very different process this time around. And one of the keys to the process this time around is that the Democrats are going to have 12 debates. And six of those debates are this year, beginning in June.
Oh, my goodness.
And in order to qualify for the debate, you have to register 1% in a national poll or at least 1% in the polls in the key early states. So what you're going to have at first is this mini primary with this large block of candidates each trying to get into that first debate. And so that's one of the things I'm really watching in terms of the polls rather than necessarily who's up and who's down.
Ron, you're just grinning. This is unusual, correct? I mean, my memory's not great, but...
It's unprecedented. I don't know. Maybe it's in part just being a political scientist, but I just find all this very exciting. In regards to what Tony was saying about finance, my students are excited about this, you know, about the apparent lack of domination by super PACs, by the candidates saying they don't want corporate donations. For about a year after the last presidential election, the students at my campus, even the conservative ones, seemed a little stunned And now the level of interest and enthusiasm about issues like campaign finance are actually really high.
Emily Kane, Emily's List raises money for candidates. Is it a different kind of ball game this time around? And if so, how?
Well, I think you're seeing all of these candidates approach it a little bit differently. Certainly, some members are putting their own money in. Others are only focused on small dollar contributions. Others are playing to sort of traditional Democratic voters. But what I will say about this is that where you see the most effort, where you see the most conversation, is in the topic of who can beat Donald Trump, right? And so you have a lot of donors right now, even small dollar donors, sort of waiting, holding back, or sort of giving smaller contributions to many candidates because they're not ready to pick yet, because they're not sure yet who is the one who can take on the president. And so I think you also have a lot of energy right now on the finance side going into what happens after we have a nominee. People marshaling resources for 2020 in advance, saying, I'm going to hold off on my big spending, let this primary play out across America for Democrats, and be ready at moment one to take it to the next level and take it all the way to November of 2020. And I think you're going to continue to see that two-track happen, where you have small dollar and the individual race for money between the candidates, and at the same time, you're going to see the Democratic Party and their allies gearing up for the big game.
The most recent entrant is Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State. I need to qualify that. I think the most recent entrant. I have not actually looked at the news headlines for 15 minutes now. And he's running on climate change. Emily, what do you see as the big issues emerging that voters care about? Is it climate change? Is it Medicare for all? Is it something else entirely?
Well, there was no question in the 2018 elections that issues around healthcare and the personal impact that conversations and debate around healthcare have on people's lives played out as the number one policy issue. I think we're going to continue to see that into this year, especially if in the Congress there are still attempts to undermine access to basic healthcare services, if there are continued attacks, which there will be, and we see Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump making this case every day with lies about women's reproductive health. There's no question the environment and climate change will be one of the things at the top of the list, but I also think we cannot have this debate about 2020 without this fundamental right of healthcare in our nation.
Ron, what do you believe would be the issues that emerge or are emerging as the most important, not to the candidates, but to the voters?
Well, I agree with Emily about the centrality of healthcare. I think that's crucial. I think that the way that healthcare affects other policies, like what the meaning of what this might mean for Social Security or for Medicare, I think is very important. The broader terms that get a lot of media attention, the Green New Deal, for example, or Medicare for All, at this point, I think are very wide open. Lots of candidates have said they're in favor of them without specifying exactly what that's going to mean policy-wise. I think that is going to probably stay like that for a while. I think the sort of broad policy areas are going to dominate a lot of the conversation before we begin to actually look at specific policy questions.
Tony?
Well, I think that generally, you know, healthcare and the environment are two things voters care about. I think as we move more into the broader thinking about what do voters care about, we're going to see a lot of attention being given still to the problem of economic inequality, a lot of attention being given to tax and regulatory policy. And I think that we're going to see more discussion in the next election about criminal justice reform and gun control than we've seen in the past, because I think those are two issues that increasingly voters are concerned about that have kind of been taboo in presidential races in the past that are now really coming to the fore.
Okay, I have a sort of just like the horse race question here. The dynamics of having so many candidates, how is that a different kind of race than, say, if we had four or five candidates at this point? I mean, does that mean that all bets are off, or does it really, in the end, not make that much of a difference? You all study this.
Well, what's interesting about this year is not simply that there are so many candidates initially, but the fact that there is no prohibited front runner, so that it's not the kind of race where there's one candidate that everyone expects to win the nomination, and therefore you quickly form into a kind of top two or three versus everybody else. So that consequently what we'll see is there will be candidates who start to emerge. And that's why Emily's point about donors, for example, holding off is an important one. You're going to see the same thing with politicians holding off on their endorsements, that this is really not going to shape up until we get into the fall. And then we'll get into a pattern where which candidates are looking to do well in those early races. And this is the kind of field where you can have three or four or five candidates go on for quite a while, particularly given the lineup of states that we're looking at in 2020. You know, this is not going to be the kind of race we saw last time that quickly kind of collapses down into Bernie versus Hillary Clinton, or the types of races where we've seen in the past where someone does well in Iowa and New Hampshire and then basically everyone else falls to the side. So I expect this race to go on for quite some time, because you have a field where there are a number of strong candidates and a very different process than we've had in the past.
I totally agree. Sorry. Go ahead, Emily.
I was going to, if I could build on that, I think the thing is, I know there's this anxiousness of let's get to the front runner and what's this race going to look like. I don't think it's time for a front runner. We have a lot of conversation to have about what's at stake in this election for our country with Donald Trump at the helm right now, that we need this group of dynamic leaders to have that conversation in front of us. This is the kind of election that I'm excited about, because we're going to get to see these candidates, some of whom we know well, right? We know Bernie Sanders. We know Elizabeth Warren. We know Joe Biden. But the ones who we don't know as well, whether that's Kamala Harris or Amy Klobuchar, Kirsten Gillibrand, or Beto O'Rourke, all of these people who are just beginning to show us who they are and what they stand for, we are in a place where we're going to benefit from that. And we're going to, in fact, if I was in this race right now, which I'm definitely not, don't worry, Jennifer.
You're not one of the 599, Emily.
No, no. But what I would say is, if I was in this race right now, I wouldn't want to be the front runner. I'd want to be the one with the path to grow, to make my way through this field, to make my case and earn that support. I think what we're going to see happen is we're going to see as many of them as possible work to get to that debate stage in the summer. And then we're going to see who shines there. Right? Who surprises us? Who's a standout? And then we'll see others start to fall back in the months that follow.
I agree. I mean, the last time, 4 years ago, we had this push to a narrative of the establishment Democrats versus the insurgent Democrats. And the Democratic Party is a very rich, diverse, enormous entity. And we're seeing that reflected right now in the state of candidates. And I'm hoping it goes on like this for a while.
Emily mentioned Joe Biden. He hasn't announced yet. Is he going to? I mean, you guys money on Biden? And if he does, how does that change everything? Is he automatically the front runner?
Tony and I were talking before the show. There was a New York Times article this morning that had no news in it, that was above the fold, that was basically, what's Joe Biden doing and why hasn't he declared yet? I would say that he probably is going to declare, but it seems to be paying off for him at this point to hesitate.
I think that Joe Biden.
He's a guy who can take his time. I mean, he can take his time, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's something not all the candidates have the luxury of.
Exactly. He doesn't have to jump in right away. I expect that he'll wait until this kind of first quarter is over so they can have the full second quarter for fundraising. He's well known. He has almost 100% name identification in the party. And I do believe that he will be getting in and he will quickly rise to be seen as, you know, the front runner. But as Emily said, you know, one of the things to look at in a large field like this, to get back to your question and to tie in with Emily was talking about the conversations, is that you're going to have a wide range of issues being discussed in this Democratic primary and lots of different emphases, where you have candidates like a Jay Inslee who focuses on climate change, or Julian Castro who's going to focus on immigration, Cory Booker, who's going to tell us about the problem of inner cities and urban areas because he actually has the experience of managing a city, and many of these women candidates who are particularly concerned about family issues and health issues, that's going to bring forward, you know, a lot of policy debates that haven't been held before in the policy kind of debates within a presidential race, and right now are just being cartooned by the Republicans as a Green New Deal or as socialism. And so there is a need for these candidates to get out and really explain to the public, here is what we support and here's the policies that we are for.
We are going to take a quick break. We're talking about the race for the White House. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Ocean View at Falmouth. an active retirement living campus proudly supporting Saturday Afternoon Opera. OceanviewRC.com.
Democratic leadership tries to keep the top on their big tent.
I don't believe it was intended any anti-Semitic way, but the fact is, if that's how it was interpreted, we have to remove all doubt, as we have done over and over again.
We explore the emerging divide for Democrats over attitudes towards Israel. It's next time on Takeaways Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRI.
The Takeaway is this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. You've heard the tones before, here on Maine Public Radio and perhaps also on Maine Public Television. Maine Public is the designated primary source for the entire state of Maine emergency alert system, which we transmit to all other stations for broadcast, to all listeners and viewers all around the state. This is a valuable and important public service tool to help inform, alert, and warn citizens when situations warrant. And Maine Public's statewide infrastructure enables it to fulfill this vital task and public service.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the race for the White House. Joining me today, Emily Kane, Executive Director of Emily's List, and former Maine State Legislator Tony Corrado, Colby College Professor of Government and Campaign Finance Expert, and Ron Schmidt, Associate Professor of Political Science at USM. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Tony Corrado, how does the change in the primary schedule affect this race?
Well, you're going to have a very different process from you had 4 years ago, and it's important in two regards. One is the order of the states are different. So we'll still have Iowa and New Hampshire as our early states, and Nevada and South Carolina will follow. But then quickly you're going to get a large number of big states and Sunbelt states. California has moved to the first week of March. Texas has moved into the first week of March. You have a very diverse electorate that's going to be seen by these Democratic candidates with very large number of delegates, so that it'll still be important to do well in an Iowa or a New Hampshire just to keep yourself in the race. But after that, the real emphasis is going to be on these big states. The second thing that it's always important to remember is that the Democrats changed their rules on superdelegates, so they no longer vote. They're not a factor this time because they were such a controversial matter last time that now they only vote if you have a convention where you can't get a majority for a candidate. So this is going to be a much more people-driven, turnout-driven race than we saw in past Democratic campaigns.
So what that makes me think, and you can grade me if I'm a good student here, is that by the middle of March, we may have a pretty good idea who our candidate is, but that candidate, it seems to me, especially with California being one of the early states, might be a nominee who may not be the best candidate in the general election against a Republican because of the kinds of states that have the early primaries.
Well, that's one theory. On the other hand, you're still going to have Nevada, South Carolina, some of the southwestern states like in Arizona,
okay,
and some of the states that are important in the general election. And so that is going to be the broader debate in the party. Do we need a candidate who can appeal to a diverse electorate and to lots of different kind of voters, or do we need a candidate who's particularly strong in the Midwest where the battle has traditionally been fought in the general election? And that's generally the debate that's going on right now between many of these other candidates and those who are thinking about Joe Biden. Would he be the best in kind of the Midwest? And this is Amy Klobuchar's basis for her candidacy, that she is from the Midwest in Minnesota and is pragmatic and therefore can appeal to the voters you need in the general election. So that's the kind of debate you're going to see in terms of the politics of the race as it starts to move forward.
We have an email from Tyler. I am of the opinion that if the election happened tomorrow, Donald Trump would win against any Democrat that has already joined the race. The Democratic Party has gone so far to the left that they're supporting unconscionable changes like the Green New Deal and third trimester abortion on demand. Unfortunately, Trump is the closest thing we have to a reasonable person in the two major parties. It might be a good year for an independent. Ron, thoughts?
We had an interesting conversation in one of my classes yesterday about what reasonable means, but nobody floated that idea. If we had the race tomorrow, that would be difficult on all the Democratic candidates, but not, I think, because of a major shift to the left on the part of the party. We have some candidates who represent a further left position than we've seen in previous presidential candidates. We have a changing idea about what issues can be fruitfully discussed in a presidential election. And then we have some Democratic candidates who, despite gender, look a lot like some previous candidates have before in terms of their policy positions. So I don't think that what we're seeing now is a Democratic Party that's more left or that is more sort of Bill Clinton center. We're seeing a party that is finding itself and its voters.
I think the other thing we have to remember is that in the past you've had basically one presidential candidate who was on the left and a number of different candidates who are kind of more moderated towards the middle. This time around we're going to have a number of candidates advocating some of these liberal policies, but from, you know, a very much more crowded area and space. And so that consequently I think what you're going to see is as many of these candidates who are actually running for president talk about the policy positions they have, they're not going to appear as far left as the perception might be of the party right now.
Emily?
Well, a couple points. I mean, to Tyler's email about the president and what Republicans are talking about right now we have a president and a Republican Party who are spending a large portion of their time with outright lies about women's health care. Outright lies about what safe and legal access to abortion is in our country and what it actually means. And they are blatantly lying about one of the most painful circumstances that women and their families face as a way to further their anti-women agenda and to further divide us as a country. And I think that's why we have to look at November 2018 as instructive as we look at what the landscape is for 2020. In 2018, we saw women get elected in record numbers up and down the ballot. And we saw them get elected in rural places like Maine with our governor, Janet Mills. We saw them get elected in the Midwest in places like Michigan with the governor there, Gretchen Whitmer, and the governor of Kansas, Laura Kelly. And we saw them in the West in New Mexico with the new governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham. We are seeing races that flipped in Maine, too, in Kansas, in Iowa, in Minnesota, in Illinois, in Texas, seats that flipped that have been traditionally Republican seats, long-held Republican seats, and in most cases, those seats were flipped by women and diverse women telling really authentic stories about healthcare, about their lives, about who they are and what they care about. We saw a record number of women veterans get elected to Congress. We have to look at what is this electorate, who are they caring about, what are they caring about, and those people are coming back. We see no waning in the enthusiasm of the electorate that came out in 2018 as we head in 2020. And the number one reason for that is Donald Trump. But I think that motivates people on both sides. And that's why these issues like healthcare, these issues like women's reproductive health matter very much when it comes to what's really at stake.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hey, I thought it was great hearing Emily Kane call out the outright lie that started off the listener input. The second thing I wanted to point out was we have a chance at one of the oddest bumper stickers ever, Boot Edge Hickenlooper. And we almost support those candidates to get that. But the real reason why I called was to support the candidacy of Jay Inslee, governor of Washington State. I really cemented that seeing him with Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, and I think people should see that. But he's got a great record as the governor on a whole bunch of different issues. I've lived 20-something years in Maine, but I used to live in Washington State. I didn't know Jay Inslee there. But I have a lot of friends from there, and across the Democratic spectrum, most of my friends think very highly of him. And he's accomplished a lot for the economy, for education. And I'm really glad that he's leading off with climate change because we have to address it.
John, thank you for your call. I'm gonna move on to other calls because we have so many coming in. But I want to just throw out there, it is interesting, Jay Inslee, the first governor to throw his hat in the ring, correct? And that's of note.
Yes.
Thank you, John, for your call. We're going to move on to Charlie from Bangor. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to first mention, I think that some of the some folks are engaging in this false dichotomy about a choice between having a real progressive and having somebody who's electable. But I'm personally supporting Elizabeth Warren for president this year. But the thing that really concerns me is that, you know, it's not just enough that we have somebody who's like a little bit less racist or a little bit less sexist or a little bit less homophobic than Donald Trump. We need a real progressive. And what concerns me is that there are so many progressives in the race this year. It worries me that the vote will split in an awkward way so that we wind up with a Joe Biden or a Tulsi Gabbard as the nominee rather than somebody who actually shares the values of the Democratic Party. And I think that we really need electoral reform.
Sure, Charlie. I think a lot of people are concerned about no matter who they support, that other candidates that are somewhat like that candidate will divide the vote. Tony, you were nodding as he was talking.
Well, yeah, that was my point earlier about we've never seen so many progressive candidates in one Democratic field. So that part of this process will be them trying to distinguish themselves from each other so that eventually you will come to a point, I think, where you will have a number of these candidates who get into that final block of candidates, and then it will depend on how they perform on the campaign trail. But that is one of the issues that the progressive candidates face right now. How do I distinguish myself on the environment or on banking regulation or on health care from so many of the other candidates in this field?
Charlie, thank you for your call. Well, go ahead, Emily.
Yeah, I just want to add one thing, because you've got, you know, John, who called with a clear support of Inslee, of Charlie, who called with a clear support of Warren. But I can't ask them because they're not on the phone anymore. But my guess is if you asked them that if the ticket was right, we have a power of a vice presidential nominee here as well, which we won't know until next year, is that none of those people, even if their number one candidate isn't the person, that I believe John and Charlie will still come out to vote and will still vote for the Democrat because Donald Trump is the president of the United States. Right. And we have to remember that I think Democrats are in it to win it. And overall, that is the number one feeling out there across the country. And that the specifics of who it is matter. Well, we do have that opportunity to have the conversation right now. But as it gets closer and gets closer, I believe we will have the coalition that comes together to support the nominee.
And we're already seeing some exciting policy proposals being made. And even if a candidate who introduces a new idea winds up not making it all the way to the nomination, their ideas can be carried forward by other candidates. And that's important.
An email from Josiah. Given the general unpopularity of President Trump, do you see many moderate and or independent voters turning to third party or independent candidates in the general election if the Democrats nominate a far left candidate such as Bernie Sanders? If so, what kind of candidate do you think could successfully attract voters that are not pleased with the two major party candidates? As a libertarian, I am not planning to vote for Trump or a Democrat, but as of yet, I have not seen any candidates I would seriously consider voting for aside from Bill Weld and perhaps Howard Schultz.
Well, this is a problem that, you know, many of the voters have these days where they feel like neither the Republicans or the Democrats really represent them. And that is the rationale between the Howard Schultz candidacy. The former CEO of Starbucks, he has announced his candidacy for president as an independent, hoping that if it is the case that there are nominees from both parties who don't really appeal to the electorate, he might offer a third way. And this is something that is often talked about each presidential election cycle. And part of the problem becomes that once you do get into the general election, you generally have a situation where the Republicans and Democrats, no matter who their nominee is, tend to support their nominee, so that it leaves very little space for an independent, since the voters, even those who say I'm independent, generally tend to vote for one party or the other. There's only about 10% of true independents out there in the electorate. So that one of the issues is going to be, do you really have a Democratic nominee who is so distasteful to the public that they feel that this is someone that they can't vote for in opposition to Trump? And that dynamic may develop, but I imagine you're going to see a Democratic nominee who is going to have significant support amongst the electorate simply because of the fact that it is the alternative to Donald Trump if the current public attitudes persist.
We'll go to Ashley, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Ashley. Go ahead.
Hi. So I think my main point is that, I mean, I appreciate the fact that there is 16 people stepping up to the plate, you know, kind of fighting against Trump. But I think for me, the most important is we need someone who has experience, who understands how politics work and how the people need change, need improvement. I feel like with Obama, we took two steps forward, and Trump is, I mean, I could go on for hours about him, but we need someone who has, like, the mental sanity to care for the people and their needs, you know? Like, as a woman, I mean, I had an abortion, you know? Like, the fact that someone wants to take that decision for me or use that power to make that decision for me is just unacceptable. So I think at this point, I'm not really decided on any candidates, but it's more who's going to be more rational, reasonable, respond to our needs, and, yeah, and move forward and make this country amazing, you know, the way it always been.
Thank you, Ashley. And I think Ashley speaks for many voters. We do need to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Breakwater Curiosity for Life, offering exceptional day school and after school options for toddlers through eighth grade. BreakwaterLearning.org. And BCM Environmental and Land Law, focused on Northern New England environmental law and land issues. NHLandLaw.com.
Who has trouble getting access to reliable internet in New England? And why does it matter?
The internet is a utility at this point. It is a necessity.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll explore broadband access around our region, plus the lobster war along the U.S.-Canada border.
This is an example of how climate change is not some distant, abstract threat, but one that is having an effect on people's lives right now.
Please join us
this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. Did you know that if you do not have cable, it is still possible to see Maine Public Television, all four channels, The World, Create, and Kids as well? In many areas of Maine, you can watch all four of our television signals with an HD TV antenna. Will that work in your neighborhood? We have created a resource to help you answer that question, including finding out the likely signal strength where you live. Go to mainepublic.org for more information, click on Television and Guide for watching over the air, or give us a call at 1-800-884-1717, and we'll send the information right away. With or without cable, Maine Public Television brings you four channels of the highest quality programming, an educational resource not to be missed.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the lineup of presidential candidates. Joining us today, Ron Schmidt with USM, Emily Kane with Emily's List, and Tony Corrado with Colby College. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Eileen on Facebook says, enough of tired careerist paid pundits and consultants. Voters, and she has voters in caps, voters just gave $10 million in a week to Bernie, $6 million in a day from small donations. 1 million volunteers signed up to work for free. Thousands attending Bernie rallies already. So, feel the dang burn already. Tony Corrado, is she onto something?
Well, she certainly is. I mean, this shows you the strength of Bernie Sanders, that he has a very loyal group of supporters that have been, you know, very active in kind of supporting many of the ideas that he advances and that have now, frankly, been adopted in part or in whole by so many other candidates. And I think that what she is pointing to is that this is going to be one of the standards we see in this election by which these candidates are going to be judged. You know, how much real people power do they develop? How much popular support? How many small donations are they going to be able to take in? Because those are the candidates who are ultimately, I think, going to be successful in this year's Democratic primary.
An email from Constantine.
Well,
oh, go ahead, Emily.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was saying, when you look at Senator Sanders being in this race, he is arguably one of the best known of anybody. So it's not really surprising that he comes out of the gate strong. What's going to be interesting for him is this is a dramatically different primary landscape than he had for the 2016 presidency. And it'll be very interesting with so many other progressives in the race, with so much more diversity among the candidates, both in age, in ethnic and religious background. It's going to be very interesting to see how his supporters, who their second and third choices are, and whether or not those people can gain traction.
I totally agree. I mean, Senator Sanders has very, very deep support in some of the important groups within the Democratic coalition, but there's a lot of groups in the Democratic coalition, and he had trouble outreaching to some of those 4 years ago. Now, I'm hard-pressed to think of groups within the Democratic coalition that don't have some candidate with some viability. So this is going to be, I think, a much more engaged field than we saw last time.
An email from Constantino.
Absolutely.
The Mueller report looms large in this matter. A damning report won't affect his 35%, but will sway independents and moderate vote. You all agree that in the general election that the Mueller report will have an impact?
I tend to think that the Mueller report is just one of many strings that are out there that could quickly unravel, and that's a lot of the uncertainty around Donald Trump. The Mueller report is really just going to be the beginning of a continuation of the investigations we're seeing now on four or five different matters. When we add that to some of the policy uncertainties that are out there, whether it's the China deal or a deal with North Korea or the effects of this tax policy by the end of next year, I think this is one of the reasons why you see so many Democrats energized about 2020 and so many candidates getting in, because there's so many different ways that the president's support could be affected by the events that are occurring.
We'll go to Sydney in Northport. Hi, Sydney. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I would like to say that I'm a physician, an arthritis physician, practicing in the Mid-Coast, and I think it's scandalous that this country cannot afford to take care of its citizens. There's so many of my patients that can't get the care or the medications that they need. But we're not going to get universal health care or climate issues addressed or the environment unless we have a new president. And I disagree a little bit with the contention that we need to pick the candidate most likely to unseat Trump. I think that any Democrat can unseat Trump if the Democratic Party coalesces entirely around that candidate. So that so I think that one of the important issues is that the Democrats pick a candidate or end up with a candidate that has universal appeal and can appeal to Democrats and independents alike, to be absolutely certain that Donald Trump is not elected again by a plurality.
I was struck by Ashley's comment earlier about the need for candidates with experience who can actually work with Congress ideally to pass legislation. So not just a veto against Donald Trump, but a real possible move forward on issues that are incredibly important.
Emily Kane.
To Sydney's point, I mean, I think go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to ask you, he says the Democrats need to rally around whoever the candidate is. Do you have confidence that this big, diverse party that you're a part of will be able to do that?
100% yes, absolutely. I think that's why, as I said earlier, I'm not anxious for the front runner yet. I think the longer we have this debate, the better off we're going to be as a party, the more we're going to understand what the ideas are within our coalition, who makes up that coalition. And I think as a result, our nominee and whoever they choose as their vice presidential nominee are going to be in a stronger position to carry this across the finish line. I believe we're fortunate. I would be with the Democratic field right now. Everybody has their sort of, everybody I know has kind of a top three or a top five list. Very few people have a one person or nobody else, right? And that's why I'm confident as we head into next year, we will coalesce around the nominee. We absolutely will. And we will be able to defeat Donald Trump because of the strength of our coalition.
Sydney, thanks for your call. We have a tweet from Marfine. In 2016, a growing number of folks said Democratic candidates need to abandon identity politics, which worries me as an LGBT person of color. Do you see signs of candidates distancing themselves from identity politics? Also, Dr. Schmidt taught me everything I know.
Oh, hi, Marfine.
So let's talk a little bit about identity politics. What does that mean exactly, and how does that play out in this race that we're talking about?
You know, some people's identity politics are other people's life or death issue politics. You know, the phrase identity politics is kind of elastic, but it's often applied to issues about race, to issues about sexual orientation, to issues that may seem overly abstract to people in the president's circle, but for big portions of the Democratic Party's coalition are very much life or death issues of civil rights and day-to-day existence.
We have Troy on Facebook.
100% true. I completely agree. I mean, I just want to say I agree with that because I think this is another one of those words, those phrases that gets thrown in there to sort of make things seem like they're separate or they're a nice to have instead of a must have. And as we talk about the Democratic primary and the issues that are important to Democratic voters, we cannot afford to sideline things that are, you know, under the so-called identity politics because they actually are fundamental issues.
We have a tweet from Sarah. What do your guests think the odds are for a Republican primary challenger to Trump? Well, we already have one, don't we?
Yes, we have former Governor Weld of Massachusetts, who is the Libertarian vice president's vice presidential candidate last time around, who has announced. And there's been some discussion of Governor Larry Hogan, former governor of Maryland, getting involved in the Republican primary. But I think that one of the things we are seeing now is that there's a lot of hesitancy about going against an incumbent president, particularly given the fact that the Trump campaign has begun very early to start its reelection campaign. But that dynamic could change if we see something come out of these investigations or if we see some turn that spins off of the Mueller report and the investigations in Congress that may lead some Republicans to decide to challenge the president. But I don't expect that we will see a serious challenge unless something like that develops.
Troy on Facebook, I think it's critical for Democrats to field as moderate a candidate as possible for 2020. It may not seem so on the surface, the best to advance all of the party platforms, but as a conservative voter who can't wait to see Trump gone, I think it is very important to appeal to middle ground and centrist conservatives as much as possible. So a different perspective there. Somebody who calls himself conservative but doesn't want to vote for Donald Trump would like to see a centrist Democrat to vote for. How common are people like Troy? How many people in the electorate, and will those people swing the general election?
I think generally what we have.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Go ahead, Emily.
No, go ahead. Well, I was going to say, I think, you know, you can speak more to the numbers probably than I can of the overall electorate. But I think, you know, Troy's point is absolutely a good one when it comes to the kind of coalition Democrats need to build to win, which means we can't alienate people from the very beginning. We have to listen to them. We have to hear them. We have to hear what's on Troy's mind and what does it mean to him to be someone who's looking for a more moderate candidate, because that terminology means different things to different people, too. And I think when we're talking about the dignity of work, something that now Senator Sherrod Brown, who's not running for president, has called on other candidates to adopt into their platforms, comes out of that desire to find those voters that we lost to Donald Trump in 2016. In states like Maine, in states like Michigan, in states like Wisconsin, places where we believe with the right message, we can win those people back with the right policy platform. Troy is exactly one of those people, and it's incumbent on all of these candidates to not forget that he's out there voting too.
Okay, and Tony, quickly, please.
Oh, I was just going to say, and this is the central problem that faces President Trump, that the first decision a voter generally makes is whether or not they're going to vote for the incumbent president. And therefore, what you're finding now are there are people like Troy who really are dissatisfied with the incumbent president, and they're going to be looking elsewhere this year.
Well, thank you all. Wow, that hour went quickly. That was Tony Corrado, professor of government at Colby College. Ron Schmidt, also here, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. And Emily Kane, executive director of Emily's List. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. We had additional help from Dave Bartlett. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.